Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining me for another episode of the Joe Prano Podcast. This is episode 11, and I remain your host, Joe Prano. I'm sitting here in my apartment in Venice Beach, recording this on a Thursday evening, and on in the background here, I've got the NFL primetime Thursday night football game about to kick off. The game is between, drumroll, the Cleveland Browns and the New York Jets. Ugh. This is what the NFL gives us on a Thursday night. Cleveland Jets. Two teams that have literally been synonymous with failure for 30 years. This is the teams that they give us? No. Thank you. I'm out, NFL. This is your primetime Browns Jets. The NFL. It's fantastic. No, I don't think so. I probably will not make it through this entire game. Now, what if I told you that next week's Thursday night game was between the San Antonio Gunslingers and the Memphis Showboats? Aren't you already infinitely more excited about that game than you are about Browns Jets? I know I am. I don't know a single thing about the Memphis Showboats or the San Antonio Gunslingers, and I'm already wishing that that game were on right now instead of Cleveland Jets. If you're nodding in agreement with me, then I have great news for you. You are going to love this episode of the podcast because the Gunslingers and the Showboats are two teams from the old United States Football League, a spring football league that existed for 3 years in the 1980s. And my guest today is Jeff Perlman, the author of the new book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. He is one of the best, if not the best, working sports writer today. He's written 5 New York Times bestsellers, including one of my favorite sports books ever, The Bad Guys Won, about my New York Mets 1986 World Championship team. He wrote Showtime about the 80s Lakers, Boys Will Be Boys about the 90s Cowboys. He wrote a book about Walter Payton called Sweetness. He wrote a book about Roger Clemens. He wrote a book about Barry Bonds. And his last book before the USFL one, Gunslinger, about the legendary Brett Favre. He, like I said, is one of the great sports writers working today, and he has really delivered on his latest book. I didn't know a ton about it when I was growing up. I was a little too young to watch the USFL. The only thing I really knew about it was a lot of the players that became stars in the NFL had played in the USFL before that. And when I would be watching football, they'd always flash back. They'd always show you Steve Young in his USFL uniform or Doug Flutie or Herschel Walker or Jim Kelly. So it was always like, huh, yeah, that was a thing. I guess I missed it. And of course, we've been hearing a lot about the USFL again lately because our president, Donald Trump, was one of the team owners for 2 seasons in the USFL, and he had a big part in the crazier demise of the USFL. But I didn't know any of the specifics about the league, and reading this book, I wish I could go back in time and experience the USFL live because the stories are so funny and so crazy and so wild that I really highly recommend, even before you start this podcast, press pause, go to Amazon, buy Football for a Buck. I promise you, you won't regret it.
Hey, Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're in my house.
So I know.
I'm having you.
Yeah, this is great. I saw on Twitter, I guess a couple weeks ago now, you put out a tweet that said you were willing to do any interview for this. Yeah. Has that come back to bite you in the ass?
I mean, I've had, yeah, I know, because I'm truly grateful that people are doing it. Like, I'm genuinely grateful. I mean, this is probably my 120th US of O interview, and I love the topic. I love talking about it, but does it start to beat you a little bit? It does, especially today, because it was Yom Kippur and I was fasting.
Right.
And I was half being a good Jew and fasting and half being a bad Jew and doing interviews about the USFL. So it got hard by the end of the day.
Yeah. So I saw you put that out there and I hit you up and you were nice enough to tell me you'd happily do the interview. I've listened to you do other interviews about the book. I've read a couple. I've watched a few. You are living up to your word. You're doing every interview that anybody will do. Are you, was part of that, part of you saying, like, I'll do anything because this is your passion project? Because I've heard you say this is a book that you've wanted to write forever. Mm-hmm. Do you always do press like this, or you do it like this for this book in particular?
Well, this has been a new level of kamikaze press where people I know are like, Jesus Christ, you are everywhere. You know, like, I was just at someone's house for breakfast, and the guy's like, I was at the gym listening to WIP, and there you are. And yeah, it's because nobody wanted a USFL book, and I wanted a USFL book, and I really feel an ownership of this subject more than other subjects. So if you're going to do it, and you're going to tell people it could be a sellable book, then you got to put your freaking mouth where your money is, you know, or vice versa. So
I start reading the book. I get the book. I start reading it. And then what hits me immediately is that you say you loved the USFL when you were a kid, and you actually wrote a paper about it when you were at Mayapack High School, which I was like, wow, I'm from Katona.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
We're from like 15 minutes apart, 20 minutes apart. And so this is when you were asked, you could write about anything in high school. You said you wanted to write about the USFL. What was it about the league when you were a kid that you said, this is what I'm going to write a high school paper on? And then so many years later say, I have to write a book about this.
Well, first of all, I want to say it's disappointing you're from Katona, because I always use the line that I'm from the mean streets of Mayapack.
Yeah.
And you know the truth.
Yeah.
There are no mean streets of Mayapack.
No.
You might encounter a squirrel.
Maybe even less than in Katona.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was it's actually hard. I wrote in the front of the book, that's true, is like my daughter's literally sitting in the other room. I remember taking her to Disney World when she was very little. And there's this like magic when you're a little kid and her going to Disney World. I mean, it's one of my favorite memories of my lifetime. And everything is enormous and the characters are real and everything is 3D. And to me, it's like, oh, another $8 for a turkey leg. But she sees it a certain way. And I remember being 10 years old and seeing the cover of Sports Illustrated in the Mayapack Library with Herschel Walker, and Hitting Pay Dirt was a headline. And I've told this story enough times, but I almost feel like it's come, but it's 100% true. Like, I literally remember seeing the magazine laid there, and they used to have them in the plastic cases so you wouldn't damage the magazine. And seeing Herschel Walker and just being blown away, and then opening it up and seeing the helmets of the original 12 USFL teams. And there was one helmet in particular, it was the Arizona Wranglers, because it was like a golden rust color. And it had a W brand, like a Wrangler, like a Western brand. It was just so different. And for me, being 10 years old, I just remember being blown away by the imagery. And I think that was where the love affair honestly began.
And when you saw that, were you immediately a convert from the NFL, or were you just like, this is my spring football league? How?
Yeah, I always grew up. My number one team when I was a kid was the Jets, like by far. Did you grow up a Jets fan?
I'm a Giants fan.
All right. You know, yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I just want to say I became a Jet fan because when I was about 6 years old and my older brother David was 8, we were sitting at the kitchen table and he said, I'm going to like the Giants. And I said, well, I like the Jets. He has not watched a game of football since then. I could have had the team with the Super Bowls, and I picked the Jets.
Yeah, no, it's funny because it's almost the complete opposite with me. I was a Mets-Jets fan originally because they go together.
Yeah.
My mom's from Queens, and I remember my very first football fandom, Freeman McNeil, Ken O'Brien, yeah. Al Toon.
Yes.
I was like, I'm a Jets fan. I had a Jets pennant, and then my brother's like, Danny, his friend, is going to take us to a Giants game. Do you want to go to a Giants game? And I was like, yeah. I mean, I'll go to any football. You know, I'm a sports freak. I'll go to any football game. And we go to a Giants game, and then we're walking on the field, and we're in the locker room, and I'm like, what's happening? And I slowly, as a very young age, started to figure out Danny is Danny Mara. His grandfather's Wellington. He owns it. I was like, I think we're Giants fans now. Right. Like, we'll go home, we'll remove the pennant quietly, and we'll just pretend we were Giants fans this whole time.
Think about how much nicer your life has been.
I know.
It's ridiculous.
I sometimes wish it had happened with the Yankees, but then I'm like, I could never root for the Yankees.
I grew up a New Jersey Nets fan, too. Wow. So it gets even worse.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. What was your question?
So you were a Jets fan first, and then you have the USFL.
Yeah, I didn't switch. It wasn't like I gave up on the NFL. I just happened to love the USFL, and since there were different seasons, you could love one. And I love the USFL more than the NFL because I just thought the USFL was much more colorful and dynamic, and it sort of reached out to you as a fan. The USFL was so desperate for fans that they would just do anything to get you to root for their teams and to root for the league. And I think that really resonated with me.
So how old were you when the USFL, when you discovered this? 10 years old.
I was 10.
So that's a perfect time to grab a new fan.
I feel like if I were, like, people in interviews have compared it to me to the XFL, which came along maybe a decade ago. And there was nothing magical to me about the XFL because I was a writer at Sports Illustrated and I was jaded and old and frumpy. You know, I wasn't 10 years old and hopeful.
Yeah.
It's just something magical about that age where everything seems bigger, you know?
So my audience is pretty young. I have a lot of fans of college age that listen to Dirty Sports and come over to this show. A lot of them are almost too young to remember the XFL.
Yeah.
What is it about the USFL that those kids should know about that league to say, go buy football for a buck? What is it? What are they going to find out in this book that they need to know about?
That was the craziest shit of all. Am I allowed to curse on your podcast?
Yes, absolutely. It's your daughter is over here.
She's
so as long
15,
as you can,
yeah. It was the craziest shit of all time. I mean, just among other, a million different things. Like, it was the craziest thing ever. And you think about the NFL now, which is very buttoned up and very, you know, two message. I mean, the USFL, the San Antonio Gunslingers put a player on the disabled list because he slammed his penis in a trunk. The USFL had a guy.
I haven't gotten to that part of the book yet.
You get there.
I can't even imagine how that would happen.
You just have to get there.
Yeah.
The USFL, the best receiver arguably in the league was this guy, Richard Johnson. And before every game, he smoked a joint to get ready to play. And his closest friend on the team was another receiver named Vince Corville. And Vince Corville saw Richard Johnson getting high every game and thinking, oh, it must be working. It's a good idea. He'd never smoked pot before. Before a game, he takes a big freaking one of his blunts and just, you know, goes to town with it. And he jogs out onto the field. And he's just dizzy out of his mind and kind of paranoid that someone's going to catch him.
Yeah.
And he drops every ball that's thrown to him and never does it again. That same team, the quarterback was Jim Kelly. I mean, the Hall of Famer Jim Kelly.
Right.
And this is just how badass USFL was. Jim Kelly was drafted by the Buffalo Bills, was supposed to sign with the Bills. He's in the Bills' offices meeting with the Bills. He doesn't want to go there, but he's resigned to it. The USFL finds out he's there. One of the representatives calls the Bills' offices, pretends it's he's a relative of the agent, and says there's been a real family emergency. We get him on the phone. And they put Jim Kelly's agent on the phone. They're about to sign a contract with the Bills. And he's like, listen, Jim, this is George Allen from the USFL. Get out of there right now, and we will make you happy, I promise you. They make an excuse, leave, and 2 weeks later, he signed with the Houston Gamblers.
Wow.
It was just a gangster league.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in 79, so I'm too young to remember the league when it was happening. But I remember being a young NFL fan, you would see Jim Kelly, Herschel Walker, Steve Young, all these guys that had days in USFL, it'd always be something that they would show in highlight packages or, oh, this is, you know, before he was the 49ers, he was, you know, in the USFL. And they, in the first year, I'm basically through the first year of the league in the book. It's kind of like, we don't know really what we're doing. We're just trying to a spring football league. How did they manage to bring in some of those names like the Herschel Walker and the Doug Flutie? Like, these guys were legit going to be NFL stars. Where did it get to the point where the USFL said, no, this is a legit option, come here?
So Herschel Walker is interesting. And since you, I mean, to younger listeners,
my fans probably know Herschel Walker as a bobsledder.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think who you would compare Herschel Walker. Because Herschel Walker came along a time before a time when you knew every player.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like that. If you grew up in New York, you weren't hearing about Georgia or Auburn. maybe you're hearing about Syracuse and Rutgers. And if you grew up in on the West Coast, you knew about UCLA football, but you didn't know about Illinois football or whatever. And Herschel Walker, everybody knew. He was a halfback at Georgia. He was a Heisman Trophy winner. He was super fast, super strong, Bo Jackson kind of before Bo Jackson. And he, after his junior year in college, he wanted to turn pro, but the NFL didn't take guys. At that point, you couldn't be an underclassman and jump. He came from a really poor family in Wrightsville, Georgia, and he called the USFL. His agent didn't. He said, Herschel wants to come out. He doesn't want to play another year. He wants to make money for his family, blah, blah, blah. And USFL really debated this because the NFL had – it violated something that the NFL didn't violate. And they were worried about colleges not allowing USFL scouts onto their campuses because they think they'd be taking everyone. But ultimately, they decided to. As soon as USFL decided to sign Herschel Walker, the Dallas Cowboys called him and said, we'll take you. If we won't tell anyone, but we'll take you. He was like, no, I already committed. So that really opened the gates where the USFL decided this guy is worth it for us. He's a marquee player. He's a superstar. It's worth it. And then what happened is the original idea of the USFL was you'd spend on one or two marquee guys. So the first draft, they started drafting these big name college players and they were spending tons of money on them. And it wasn't that long before Joe Namath had jumped. It was less than 20 years before Joe Namath went to the American Football League.
Right.
So the idea wasn't crazy that you would go to a different league. So guys just started, the money's coming, the money's big. Okay. And the NFL thought it was a joke for a little while. And then guys like Steve Young and Jim Kelly just start going, and it wasn't a joke anymore.
Right. I think the number I heard you say, was it 360-something interviews for this book?
I have it about 430.
430. Okay. As a writer, like where, when you have... For all of your books, you I know you do tons of interviews. Right. Where do you even start? Like, what is the single first thing you do? You're like, okay,
they said
I can do the USFL book. What's the first thing you do? What's the first call?
I did something different this time. This is the first time I've ever done this. I put on Twitter, I'm writing USFL book. I never do that. I'm a nervous Jewish man from New York. And anyone who's Jewish and from New York can identify with that nervousness. I never do that. But I knew this book was going to be a freaking slog, and I knew I only had a year to do it because of the money. I usually get 2 to 3 years. I took a year. So I put it out on Twitter and Facebook, and that was really important. So I started getting, you know what? My uncle played in the USFL. My so-and-so. The other thing I did is I went on eBay, and I bought all the USFL media guides. Probably cost me $200, and I bought it, probably ended up with 50. I didn't buy them all, but most of them, 50 media guides. And what I do is I go through them literally, name by name by name, make a Word file for each person. Then I go about going back online and finding them. And it could be Google, it could be Nexus, it could be whatever, Facebook, finding them. And I become this machine where I am just dogged about finding every guy I can. Because one of the important things I've learned in my book is...
Everybody, doesn't matter who they are, doesn't matter how long they played.
Ball boy, office secretary. I have this theory in my head. When I was growing up in Mayo Pack, there's a kid who lived up the street from me named Dave Fleming. And Dave Fleming went on to pitch for the Seattle Mariners. And when I was a freshman in high school, Dave was a senior, and I didn't know him. He lived half a mile up the street. And one day I had a conversation with him on the bus. I was asking a kid behind me named Scott Wunder, like a trivia question about sports. And Dave Fleming answered, right? Dave Fleming, there's no way he would remember that conversation. But I remember it because to me, Dave Fleming was super huge and larger than life. My whole thing is like, all these people are going to remember their big, larger than life moments, mm-hmm. right? So you can call it doesn't matter if it's Herschel Walker or if it's the Generals' third string center. They're going to remember these magical moments. So the big guys are the little guys are just as important as the big guys. So I call everyone, absolutely everyone. The other thing is Doug Flutie's probably told USFL stories 17,000 times in his life. Well, the backup linebacker hasn't told one in 25 years.
Right. In reading the book, that's the thing is you know, there's all these crazy stories and I'm reading it and I'm like, I can't believe this happened, from the drugs, the sex, the violence between teammates and people assaulting their coaches. And I'm reading it and it doesn't really matter who's telling the story.
Makes
like you go
difference.
Back and you're like, it's Johnson. Who's Johnson? Like right. I'm not old enough to remember any of these players. You introduce the person, but there's already so many names and they have it. It doesn't matter. But like, you know, when you have the Herschel Walkers and you have the Jim Kellys, that's one thing. But like you said, they're not going to give you these nuggets. But then how does it even Like, I just imagine that your wall is like a crime scene investigation, like a lot of like note cards and strings and
a lot of folders. I'm big into manila. I print everything out. It didn't happen with this book as much, but like my book before is about Brett Favre.
Mm-hmm.
I probably printed out, I'm not proud of this, 10,000 pages of notes, just massive notes. And you put them in folders and you go, I'm the guy you see in Starbucks and you think he's homeless. Like, I'm the guy with the big bag filled with stuff, dressed like this in basketball shorts and a crappy t-shirt I bought at a thrift store. And I'm talking to myself and you think, I don't want to go near that guy. I don't know where he's been.
This is your eighth book?
Yeah.
And how many of those have been New York Times bestsellers?
Five.
And when you have that amount of success, does that allow you to have somebody that works with you? Do you have somebody who's toting your folders around?
No, nobody. Me.
It just seems like such a crazy amount of work. And it's almost like to call you a writer would be, it's like almost unfair, because somebody can go sit down at that Starbucks with a laptop and create something and say, I wrote. And meanwhile, you have all of this research and all this work that comes before you even start writing it down.
Well, you know, I said this recently to someone. Like, so we watch a lot of, in this house, we've seen A League of Our Own about 10 times. Great movie.
Classic. Yeah.
And there's the line that I like the most in that movie is not one of the classic lines. It's when Gina Davis quits the team because Bob has come home. And Tom Hanks is kind of giving her trouble, the manager. And he says, she says, it just got too hard. And he says, it's supposed to be hard. If it weren't hard, everybody else would be doing it.
Right.
And that's kind of how I feel like you could write. I'm not saying my books are masterpieces. I'm not saying they're the best books ever. But I'm saying I don't want to take the easy way out. Like, I want to do the research and I want to do the digging and I want to know that I caught every single. Something I learned at Sports Illustrated is about making every call and making the extra call and just going at it super hard. And it's exhausting and it's draining. My wife will tell you there are days I'm just like, why? I just want to be a barista. That was my thing recently. I just want to be a barista. It just going to be so nice to be. I do think it'd be great to be a barista for a day a week. But the hard part is what makes it the reward, you know?
Yeah.
It really is. So you just go after it.
The first time I remember seeing your name in a byline as a Mets fan was the John Rocker.
Yeah, that was not surprising.
When you wrote that at the time, and for people listening who don't know, John Rocker was a closer, a racist reliever for the Atlanta Braves. That was the first article that I remember almost acting in the media like things do now in the social media age, where I read quotes from it before I read the article.
Yeah.
Like, it went so crazy. And it's
the seven back train.
And all that stuff. Do you know when you're sitting down there and you're interviewing and you're taking down this quote, are you going, oh my God, I can't believe he's saying this. This is going to be a thing?
I think it, the first point when I realized, like, this is different, because I was only 27. Tom Verducci was a baseball writer at SI. I was his backup. I literally was the backup. Tom was doing the Yankees. I was getting the Mets, you know, it was like that. And I'd written a John Rocker profile during the playoffs and I never ran. And it was a very positive story of John Rocker. It was like, because I didn't get much access to him. So it was this kind of puff piece, use the nuggets you can get. And I went down to freshen it up. So there's a story written. My editor's like, go freshen it up. And I'm driving with him very early on. And we're driving down this highway in Atlanta. And there's a car in front of us that's swerving and driving slowly and erratically. And Rocker says to me, fucking Asian women, they fucking can't drive. And we pass the person. It was a white male. and then in like 2 seconds later, we get to a toll booth. And he tries throwing money in and it doesn't open. And the guy behind starts honking and he rolls down the window and he goes, fuck you. And then spits on the toll booth. So those two things, it might have been the toll booth first and then the woman, but I think it was a woman first. Anyway, those two things in very close proximity, they tell you that you're not with a normal profile subject. So he was crazy.
And he, I mean, he ended up being a villain. Like he was.
He already was, actually.
Yeah. And I remember as a Mets fan, we would go to Shea Stadium and it was like we were there first to harass John Rocker and Chipper Jones and then to root for the Mets. Like that's what that story did for people. And as a you grew up a Mets fan. Mm-hmm. When you're writing that, are you worried that people are going to say, oh, this is a Mets fan out to get a Braves guy?
No, because I never identified as a... Once I... The truth of the matter is, and I really do mean this, I haven't rooted for a baseball team in decades. And when I started covering baseball, people think like, oh, it's so hard to be unbiased. I didn't find it hard at all. Like, mm-hmm. I was a professional. My job was to cover baseball. I no longer am rooting for a team. Easy. In fact, I had a friend of mine from college one time, this is years and years ago, sent me a text and, oh, your team's doing well. And I had no idea what he was talking about. Like, I really had to think about, oh, he means, I just, no. The thing that I thought people more latched onto who defended him was New Yorker, Jewish, you know, he's going to be there with an agenda.
Right.
That sort of thing.
I mean, I've even seen in some of the responses to some of your social media, the interviews you put out, people are just attacking you for all that stuff still because you just are mentioning Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's got to be crazy to think that you're writing this book about the USFL. You love this football league, and now everybody's coming after you saying, oh, this is a Donald Trump takedown piece. Was any part of this book and how it came to be published centered around Donald Trump being the president of the United States?
No, the only thing that even mentions it is the epilogue of the book, which obviously you would mention it. I pitched a book for 9 years, so it wasn't like 9 years ago the idea of this was even possible. The one thing I keep saying that I really believe is you could not report a book about Donald Trump in the USFL and come away from that thinking this guy should be president. I'm just saying it's impossible. It would be right. Impossible. I don't care if you're the most hard right Republican, which I am not, or a liberal Democrat, which I more am. You could not research this book and at the end be like, you know who'd be a great president for this? You know who's a real, you know who'd be a real sort of statue of virtue and decency? Donald Trump. That's who we need as president. You couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. So, and I always say that to people. I say, like, you try researching a book on the USFL and coming out of that thinking Donald Trump is worthy of this job. You just can't.
I've heard you say in interviews that there's a lot of parallels in some of the actions of Donald Trump while being an owner in the USFL to him as a president.
Yeah.
And I won't make you repeat it. I know you've done a million interviews. But one thing about Donald Trump that I find interesting that is the only reason a lot of some young people might have heard of the USFL is this theory that Donald Trump's attacks on the NFL now are related to his time in the USFL, wanting to be a part of the NFL, and never being allowed to be a part of the league. Do you believe in the research that you've done for this book and just knowing everything you do about Donald Trump and the USFL and his relationship to the NFL? That's true.
100%. I mean, no doubt about it. He, this is what I always say, not to get overly political, but I'm worn down and I don't mind doing it. This is a guy who gave $0 and 0 cents to 9/11 causes. This is a guy who mocked a POW who was, you know, in a camp for 4 or 5 years, John McCain. This is a guy who on 9/11 lied about seeing people celebrating atop a building in Jersey City. This is a guy who bragged about having the tallest building on 9/11. And this is coming from a New Yorker who's right. There on 9/11. 9/11 is a very raw spot for me. This guy's not in a position to lecture people about patriotism in any way, shape, or form. And if you look at his history in football, he tried buying the Baltimore Colts and failed. He had a secret meeting with Pete Rozelle trying to undermine the USFL and trying to get an NFL team and failed. He tried suing the NFL and failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills and failed. He tried buying the Dallas Cowboys and failed. And he tried buying the New England Patriots and failed. For a guy who hates the NFL so much, this guy sure wants to be in the NFL. The other thing is when he was an owner of the Generals, he sat during the anthem. And the funny thing is, I wouldn't harbor any. I've sat during the anthem too.
Yeah.
I forget to take my hat off. I've had a phone call where I'll be like, yeah, sorry. You know, like, nobody would begrudge you for that. I don't begrudge him for that. But give me a break about this Captain America bullshit. It's just laughable.
Yeah.
And it just infuriates me. Like, it's just a stupid wedge issue that worked. And I do think people are starting to tire, even right-leaning football fans. At some point, you just want to watch a game.
Right.
I think. And I think it's gone very old.
And I think the NFL, I'm a huge football fan, but I said going to this, like, if this anthem thing, and I'm completely obviously in support of people doing whatever, I don't care if they are on a lawn chair drinking a Mai Tai. Like, It's America. It's the land of the free,
it's a
right?
Song.
Yeah.
It's a song. It's a song.
But I was saying, I'm not going to watch this year. I don't need it. I could have my Sundays back. I don't have to get up at 10 a.m. here in California and not be done until 8 p.m. Great. I can, easy for me. I'll surf every Sunday. But, you know, I think they made the right move in saying, like, it's not going to be a thing this year. We're not going to address it. It's not, I mean, it's already died down. It's already people just care less.
I would have loved, though, I got to say, I would have loved for Goodell to have held a press conference and be like, you know what? If you look at our league, we have donated X amount to troops over the years. We have honored troops a million blah, 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 blah ways, because I'm sure they have. I want to see, show me what the president has done. Show me what this man has done. And how dare you question the patriotism of our players and our league? Man, I think, yeah, would have turned some people off. I think people would have been like, right on, man. I think his rep would be way high in the air right now.
Well, when I read the USFL book, to go back to it, the one thing about reading it, and again, I didn't experience it when it was happening, sounds fun, sounds different, sounds almost lawless, ruleless. Mm-hmm. Guys are drafted to teams, but then other guys are just handed to teams because this team's willing to pay them. The idea that players were going to regional teams because they start at schools in that region, it is a completely different league than the NFL. It wasn't saying we're trying to be the NFL, we want them to envelop us, and that's the end game here. We're doing something different now with everything that's going on with the NFL, whether it be the anthem, CTE, all the things that make people sort of upset about the NFL, no guaranteed contracts, you know, players not getting taken care of. Do you think that football is ripe for another shot like the USFL, somebody to do something, or is the NFL unchallengeable at this point?
So I think the biggest problem with football right now is the oversaturation. Like, I really do. I mean, you're young, you're old enough. Remember Monday Night Football used to be an event?
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It didn't even matter who the team was. Holy, Lions are playing the Buccaneers tonight. 9 o'clock, I'm turning the TV on. You'd hear the music, it would give you chills. It could be OJ and Namath and whoever was in the booth. You were in. I was in. And Sunday games felt like, it was like, oh my God, the Jets are playing the Dolphins at 4. I'm watching.
Yeah.
There's just so much football now that it's, I keep using this line, but I really mean it. I love chocolate. I don't eat chocolate every hour of my life.
Yeah.
And I feel like football is so ubiquitous. I think it'll be hard for a league really to crack through because I don't think there's more of a need. Think about college too.
Right.
You can see any college game, I would turn on TV and I would get the UConn crappy football game or Rutgers or Syracuse.
Yeah.
And there'd be one national game per week. And that was it. I can turn on the TV right here and watch the Akron Delaware game, you know?
Right. Yeah. It does seem like, and I mean, it's just with the fantasy, with
fantasy.
The Sunday ticket, with, you know, every college now having their own network. Like you said, when I was a kid, I'd watch Notre Dame football on Saturday.
Yeah.
That's it. The Giants game on Sunday, Monday Night Football. It's three football games a week.
Yep.
Now I'm watching three football games simultaneously.
Right. And I love a good friend of mine hosts the Good Morning Football show on the NFL Network. His name's Kyle Brandt. He's a great guy. They do great work. I love that show. But, I mean, the NFL Network, like, who's watching all this stuff all the time? Who's this into football? Sometimes I do sound like an old man, and that's all right. But I just think it's too much. And I also think the other thing is, I don't think the battle anymore is just with other sporting events or like my kids, their number one thing they like to do, especially my daughter sitting there, is a phone.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure younger fans, given the choice between seeing the Omaha Orlando Alliance League game or hanging out and playing Fortnite or whatever, are going to go with football.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's the same mentality as it used to be when we were growing up.
The first of your work that I read, obviously after the Sports Illustrated stuff, the first book, as a Mets fan, the bad guys won.
Yeah.
As a Mets fan, I was 7 when the Mets won the World Series in 86. And that's like my first real sports memory.
Yeah.
So big. So that book was everything to me, reading everything about those guys. And then I have followed your career since, and it's Showtime Lakers, Walter Payton. What is it about the 80s that seems to keep you coming back. The USFL, Peyton.
Yeah. I mean, it's my hotspot as far as when I was growing up, and I'm a huge nostalgia guy. I really am. I'm a huge nostalgia guy. Sports to me, music. I love Hall & Oates. I love Hall & Oates. Why do I love Hall & Oates? Number one reason, I remember buying my brother the H2O album when I was a kid and just staring at the album. Kiss. Kiss is the worst band of all time. Their music sucks. So why am I still mesmerized by Kiss? Because I remember staring at the Destroyer album and thinking they were burning down a city. You know, like that, for me personally, I don't lose that stuff. I'm always intrigued. I would love to write a book about Kiss and the Destroyer album or Hall & Oates' H2O. Like, there's just something about things when you were a kid long ago that bring out like the warmies.
Is that more work for you? Is writing a book about the 80s with all the research and getting in touch with everyone, is that harder than when you wrote a book about Brett Favre?
No, it's not. In a way, it's a little easier because the more recent someone is, the more reluctant people are to talk. So, you know, a lot of people with Favre, it was, well, did you talk to Brett or is it okay if I talk? Or they just hesitate about it. 86 Mets, it's just like the USFL, it feels like a long ago frat party. And we can talk about that. That was long enough, you know?
Yeah. With the Favre book, I didn't read the Favre book, but I've heard you talk about it and I was doing my research. You didn't talk to Brett Favre.
No.
Did you know that going in or was it like, I'm going to start this process and I'm going to.
I've had 86 Mets. I didn't talk to Gooden and Strawberry. One was in jail at the time. I wrote a Barry Bonds book. I had interviewed Bonds for an SI story, but he didn't talk for the book. Roger Clemens didn't talk for the book. I'd interviewed him in the past, but he didn't talk. So Cowboys, Emmitt Smith didn't talk. Trey Aikman didn't talk. You just kind of roll with it.
Yeah.
The thing that happened with Favre that I've never had happen before that was super weird is I didn't know early on if he was going to talk. I was getting mixed signals. But I reached out to his I found his sister, Brandy, on Facebook, and I DM'd her on Facebook. I sent her a message. Hey, my name is Jeff Perlman. I'm doing a book about your brother. And she's like, oh, that's so cool. And I was like, if I ever come to Mississippi to report it, would you be willing to talk? And she's like, yeah, just hit me up. So I'm in Mississippi, and I DM'd her on Facebook. She's like, why don't you just come to the house? I go to the house. Brett's mom and Brett's sister are both there. They're like, did Brett agree to talk to you? And I'm like, well, he hasn't yet, but I'm kind of hoping. And at that point, I'm expecting, well, come back when he does. They're like, so what do you want to know? 6 hours later, I'm sitting there with Brett Favre's mom and sister still talking. And I got his entire family except his wife. So it was it just worked out.
And when you're writing these books and you're, again, it's so much research involved. At what point do you say, I'm done? Like, I have it. I mean, like, you write a book about Brett Favre, but you don't have Brett Favre.
Yeah.
What point do you say, well, I have enough?
Well, so generally I do all my research and then I write. So, like the USFL book, I gave myself 9 months of research, 3 months of writing. 9 months is over. I'm pretty much over. Favre book, I had 2 years. So I give myself a year and a half. I'm just going to research. Year and a half. I'm not writing. I'm not picking up a pen. I'm not touching a lap. I'm just researching. And with 6 months to go or whatever it is, okay, I'm done. And if Brett Favre happens to call me, great. But otherwise, I'm done. So I just set a limit for myself. And that's it.
How much of that is when you're interviewing people, how much you're doing over the phone, how much you're traveling? Like the USFL, I got to imagine, especially just from the stories in the book, these guys, there's one guy was living in a halfway house while playing.
He's dead now, though.
He's dead, right.
He's dead.
But when you start hearing all these stories, like how many people are you like, well, this guy is not on Facebook. He's not on the phone. How much of it is going, I really feel like I need to talk to this person. I'm going to get in my car or I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to go somewhere. And
There were, I didn't do that many in person because I just didn't have the time. I did the owner of the Houston Gamblers, Jerry Argovich, lives like 4 hours away. So I drove to see him. Ed Luther, the quarterback for the Jacksonville Bulls, literally lives a mile and a half away. And my son thought it'd be funny to go track him down. And I met him at the Starbucks near here eventually. And then the big one, which I've talked about a lot, you've probably heard, is this guy, Greg Fields. Did you hear the story?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, so this guy, Greg, he's kind of the star of the book, I would say. You probably haven't gotten to him yet. His nickname was Big Paper. He's the best fighter.
Yes, I did hear you talk about it, but yeah, please, it's fantastic.
It is really good. It's one story, like I'm not tired of talking about Greg Fields. It's so great. Greg Fields, his nickname is Big Paper. He was a rookie with the Baltimore Colts out of Grambling, 1979. His nickname is Big Paper because he would call the he was the lowest paid call, and he would call the wealthy players Big Paper. He'd be like, "There goes a Big Paper boy," and they'd be like, "Big Paper, Big Paper." So his nickname became Big Paper. He plays 1 year in Baltimore, goes to Atlanta, is cut by the team, refuses to leave. They have to bring in an armed security guard to get him out. That's it for him in the NFL. But he goes to the USFL, and he signs with the LA Express, plays with them in 83. 84, the coach is John Hadle, and he decides he's going to cut him. Well, he calls him in to cut him, and Greg Fields punches him in the face. And they have to hire – they end up hiring Liberace's security guard away from Liberace to come protect the coach because this guy allegedly is making death threats throughout the year, and he's showing up at practices just staring people down. Liberace's security guard comes. He's putting trackers on his car. Fields is crazy. And then one day, just because it's the USFL and the USFL is nutty, the San Antonio Gunslingers sign him as a free agent. They just need a pass rusher. So they bring in Greg Fields, and the Gunslingers stop paying their players late in the 85 season, and Fields follows the owner home with a baseball bat and says, "I want my money." And the guy comes out with $17,000 in cash. And Greg Fields drives off. Now, I couldn't find Greg Fields at all. I call Grambling, interview different players, teammates, nothing. I did find two possible addresses for him on Nexus Lexus. So I told my son, who's nine then, 11 now, I was like, "You want to go on a road trip and find Greg Fields?" And he was into the USFL. Now they're so sick of me talking about it, they never want to hear anything about it again. But at the time, they were like, "Oh, into it." He's like, "Yeah, let's do it." So we drove up to San Francisco, and we stayed in a hotel. We took this super long walk to this address. We start going through like really bad areas of San Francisco, and I've got my nine-year-old kid with me. I'm thinking I'm not a good dad. And went to the one address, didn't find him. Went to the second address. His sister answered the door. And she said, "That's my brother." And I was like, "Could I have his..." So anyway, I really want to reach him for this book. And she took my number. And 20 minutes later, I was driving home, and Greg Fields called me. And he's like, I was like, "I've never been happier to talk to anyone. Greg, I'm doing this book, blah, blah, blah." So the next day, Sacramento, California, my son and I, the next morning, drove an hour to Sacramento. And it was me, my nine-year-old son, and Greg Fields in a food court in a mall at a Cold Stone Creamery eating Cold Stone. That was the best track down I've ever had in my life. Like the hardest, but most worth it track down ever.
When you felt like you had to talk to him. Because
I at least had to try.
Yeah, because you have all the stories. How... when you're doing a book like this and you get, okay, here's an anecdote about somebody, here's a story, how much research you have to do on saying, I've got to get X amount of people to tell me the same thing, or I've got to hear it from the horse's mouth. Like, some of the stories in this book are so crazy that you go, this guy was coked out playing, you know, low budget football in the 80s. This could be an acid trip. You know what I mean? This could be just completely made up.
Right. So I always try to get confirmation from multiple people. It obviously depends on the level of the story. If some guy's like, "We were terrible that day," okay, fine. Or like this one guy, Chuck Clanton on the Birmingham Stallions, told me a story how they lost to the San Antonio Gunslingers. The night before, he was at a party and a bunch of the players were doing coke. Right. And he was there too. He's not naming names. I can take your word on that. In 1984, you were at a party and you were doing coke. The Greg Fields stories, I had a bunch of people tell me crazy Greg Fields stories. You know, like, it just depends how specific, how hyper-specific it is. The problem is, it's definitely a flawed system because it's 30 years ago.
Right.
And if you ask me to tell you a story from 30 years ago, it's tough. I could tell you some things, but was a guy wearing a red shirt or a blue shirt? Was it here or there? I don't, you know, was it day or night? So there is a flaw to it all. And you just try really hard to confirm as thoroughly as you can. But memories are tricky, you know?
Is that something that you worry about when the book comes out?
Of course.
How often do you get a call after the fact that says, "Hey, this is all bullshit, man," like you, and you know it's true, or you're pretty sure it's true, and you've got to kind of defend yourself to, "Hey, I talked to 10 people. They all said you slammed your dick in a trunk."
Very rarely. You know? That almost never happens. It has happened. But it rarely happens. And, you know, I don't mind defending myself or whatever. Right. And I don't mind admitting I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, if I did something and it was sloppily done, I mean, I try to admit it. And I don't think it's happened where I've had to take something out of a book, but I'm willing to admit that there are flaws in the system, you know?
I've heard you say that the reaction from people just to the idea of doing a USFL book is no one wants a USFL book.
Yeah.
No,
my agent said that.
Yeah, no one cares. And I've heard you say that basically you got a package deal and you said you'd do the Favre book and you'd take less money to do this book because you just wanted to do it. What like when you're pitching it, what about the USFL book are you like, I'm willing to take it at a, I mean, you didn't take it at a loss, but like,
why? I almost took it at a loss. I did not make, this was terrible money. I mean, this one.
Why did you feel like you had to tell it?
It's actually an interesting question. I think, that's an interesting question.
I mean, I'm glad I got one in there.
No, that's a good one. No, but that's a good one. It's, I guess it's like this. If you look at my, the 7 books I've written, right? 86 Mets, if I can go in order. Barry Bonds, Dallas Cowboys, Roger Clemens, Walter Payton, Lakers, Favre. That was pretty good. None of those subjects. So 2 of those were not bestsellers, Bonds and Clemens, right? But they all had a shot based solely on subject matter. Favre comes with a huge following. Walter Payton comes with an even bigger following. The 86 Mets came up with a ridiculous following. Bonds and Clemens didn't sell that great, and I really think a lot of that was timing. Lakers come with a huge following. But the USFL doesn't, right? The USFL is a weird, quirky period in time. I was on a show today, Rich Eisen's show, and the 2 guests before me, one there was an actor and a guy he was playing, and they're both in their early to mid-30s. They had no idea what the USFL was. And I was thinking, that's the challenge right there, right? It's like challenging people to buy a book that they don't know anything about, a league they don't know anything about. And I don't think I was coasting on my other books, but every now and then you're allowed to freaking just challenge yourself. And I hadn't really done that. Every subject I picked, one of the big criteria was, can this sell? And the USFL, I don't know. It's not going to be, definitely won't be my bestseller. Probably won't make the New York Times list. It was just a labor of something it was just like a challenge hanging there and something I loved. And I thought, why not? That's pretty much it.
And obviously, if it does make the bestseller list, great. But if it doesn't, are you sitting here going, well, they were right. No one wants a USFL book. Or you're like, no, I'm glad I did it. You know, this was my labor of love. And it's out there.
Well, I mean, right. So I found out today, it's been out a week. And I found out today, it just missed the list, right?
So you're good.
I was disappointed. Okay. I was really disappointed. I was really disappointed. Like I was upset. And I don't really know why. I don't really have a good reason for that.
Yeah.
Like, why am I? I did a speaking event last night, a book group, and 2 nights ago. And I was complaining to them, a writer's group. I was like, yeah, I'm only like 380th on Amazon. And then I actually stopped myself and said out loud, I actually apologized. I was like, what a spoiled fucking asshole I am right there. Like, boo-hoo. You wrote a USFL book. It was published. I sold 5,000 copies of that book this week, my first week. That's a lot of fucking books. It's not Bob Woodward.
Yeah.
That's a good, for a league nobody remembers, you know, like, then have, you know, like you said, 80% of the population doesn't know existed. That's a pretty heavy lift right there.
Yeah.
And because like 15 books outsold mine, and mine was probably 17th or 16th, what are you getting upset for? But it's, you get spoiled by, I don't even know what your question was, but you do get spoiled by past. Like when The Bad Guys 1 came out, I didn't know anything. Nothing. I don't even think it's that good of a book, to be honest with you. I mean, it has its strengths. And then it made the bestseller list. Well, all of a sudden your expectations change and you go from just being happy about writing a book to wanting something every time. And if you think that way, you're always going to let yourself down to some degree, you know?
Yeah.
So here I am.
Like, yeah, because I mean, most writers are sitting out there going like 5 New York Times bestsellers. Like, I just want a book that I don't self-publish, or right. My goal is just, can you imagine one out there? And you're trying to get up there. You're like, you've been told no one wants USFL book.
Yeah.
And you're missing it by 2 spots and you're still.
You know what it is? This is going to sound.
Well, here, the good news is you're on the Joe Prano podcast now. So next week,
I'm in.
You're in.
Great. Please.
If the couple thousand people that listen to this all buy it.
Or buy 2 books each.
Yeah, there you go.
It's like I've had this like charmed existence writing books. Like I'm one of the lucky ones, 100%. And you always want like, then I look at like the Michael Lewis's and Laura Hillebrand's and writers like that. And like, you want to, you kind of want to get there, you know, but it's really hard. It's just really hard. And you should just be happy with where you are. And I am happy with where I am, but I'm your typical insecure writer, you know?
Are you already working on or already planning the next project, or is this just promo time now?
No, I'm somewhat, I've taken a month off. I can't say what it is because I'm, as I said, a paranoid Jewish guy from New York.
Right.
But yeah, I've had to take a month off. It's been a little disconcerting, but I'm deep into it. And it's hard after writing a book that you dreamed about to write a book that you're happy to be doing, but not, it's not your dream book.
Can you say whether or not it's sports related?
Yeah, it's sports.
Is there any part of you that says I'm going to have to step out of the sports zone at some point?
Oh yeah. My dream, USFL was my dream sports book. Tupac is probably my dream book. And I started writing a proposal 2 years ago, and I found out another writer named Kevin Powell was working on a Tupac book. I haven't heard anything about it, so maybe he's not, but that's my dream.
Why Tupac?
It sounds corny being a guy from suburban New York.
I mean, Mayapack.
I know. You know, I know. I mean, straight like, out of Mayapack.
Even, you know, obviously being from suburban, you know, downstate New York, you wouldn't think super hip hop guy, but of course, so many kids from our area were crazy hip hop people. You would think that you would have leaned East Coast rap.
Well, Tupac's from Baltimore.
Right.
So I just find him fascinating. I think he's an amazing lyricist. I think his life is really interesting. Of course, he's still alive, so I could find him. You know, like I found Greg Fields.
Yeah.
I heard he's working at the Burger King in Tacoma.
Right.
I just, I love his
that
music.
That would certainly get you on the bestseller list.
Oh, my God.
The final, no. Couldn't get far if got Tupac.
Man, that would be amazing. I consider him a really important figure in modern music and would love to write about him.
I saw that you tweeted that your book has a trailer. And was a hip hop song that went along with that.
Yeah, MC White Owl.
How did that come about? Because I can't wait to tell you the link to this show. But how do you end up having MC White Owl do a song about Trump and the USFL as a trailer for your book?
It was good, right?
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. So the Owl is he's a great friend of mine. I was at this is years and years ago. I moved here from New Rochelle, New York,
mm-hmm.
and we had really good friends as neighbors. And one day I was at a party and I was talking to their brother-in-law, and it's this guy named Aaron. And he's like, I used to be in a hip hop group in the early 2000s. And we started talking and blah, blah, blah. Next thing I know, I wrote a Walter Payton book. He did a song for that. Laker book did a song for that. And this one, I really wanted a song, and he was really into this one. And the beauty of it all, so he did that song. And this kid who went to University of Delaware emailed me. And he's like, hey, I'm graduating. And he was a video arts major or something. He's like, if you have any advice on a job. And I was like, I don't have advice, but I'll pay you $500 if you want to do a trailer. He's like, I'm in. And so, you know, it was like a good deed to a Delaware Blue Hen. And the guy kicked ass.
So if you listen to this episode that we're doing, if you listen to any of the episodes of Joe Prano Podcast, I have a theme song that a friend of mine wrote. And he wrote the theme song for my first ever podcast, Acoustic Comedy, and his name's Doug Ray, and he was in
what?
Bad Ronald.
Did you just throw that on me as a...
Yeah.
What?
Is that crazy?
You were friends with Doug Ray.
I'm friends with Doug Ray. Doug Ray has done the theme song for now two of my podcasts.
Okay.
And
that is a weird
and
thing
was a
time.
Guest on this show in episode 4, I think.
That is
and
super.
Talks about Bad Ronald and then DJ White Owl and the whole thing. And
so you know Let's Begin?
Yeah.
Not a bad song.
Yeah, great. Yeah. I met Doug just after that song came out and at the Katona Bar and Grill, and he came in wearing cornrows and a full denim, and I was like, this fucking guy. But came to be great friends with him and still talk to him to say he's done all of my theme songs. But when you tweeted it, I'm listening to it. I'm like, where do I know this voice from? Then like I look it up and yeah, I was just like, first we have the Mayapack Katona connection and now we've got
Bad Ronald
doing our teasers
that's
for everything.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. That's kooky. That's really kooky. That's funny.
So one question I always ask when I have a writer on, and I do it with musicians for music, but for the writers, it's my desert island question. You're stuck on a desert island for a year. You can bring as much written word as you want, but they all have to be by the same person. Whose writing do you bring with you?
Oh, craps. Whose writing do I bring with me? Now, I could try to be fake here and be like, you know how writers always need to be pretentious and pretend. I'm not as well read as a lot of writers. I mean, I read a ton of stuff. I would say, I know you can edit this, so.
That's good. We'll leave it all so they know exactly how much you had to think
MC
about
White
this.
Owl. I'd bring the writings of MC White Owl. You know what I would bring? This is going to sound silly, but it's since I want to write. I would bring every Tupac lyric because I feel like there's like a treasure trove of eternal Tupac writings. He also wrote poetry, and I think I'd be pretty content for a long period of time. I mean, my favorite book of all time is Autobiography of Malcolm X. I also love the series of Lyndon Johnson biographies by Robert Caro. Cano.
But not something you could read over and over.
Yeah, I could read Tupac lyrics forever, actually. Yeah, and try to figure out what he's talking about.
I mean, your love of Tupac. Like,
I love Tupac.
We need. I feel like I've actually been pretty open about it. I think I'm not the biggest Tupac fan. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Again, suburban white kid. I don't know how I got pulled into like a Biggie Tupac beef and like very much was like I'm Team Biggie and like funny. I'm 39 years old and now still will never let it go. But
we could shoot each other right now.
Yeah, right. It's just like dead in the kitchen in Laguna Niguel. I think you need to do it just so I can. I feel like I need to get the appreciation for Tupac via you. Like,
great, give me a book deal.
Okay,
give me half a mil to write the book. I mean,
perfect. Yeah. And then I mean, obviously the rap trailer for that's going to be too easy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, White Owl would be all over that.
Yeah,
maybe we can get Doug Gray. We can get the Bad Ronald reunion. I think it ended a little messy.
Yeah, it did. I mentioned it to Doug Ray today. I said, watch this trailer. I'm interviewing Jeff today about his book. And he just texted me back. He's like, oh, my God.
Oh,
and he goes, you got to bring it up. He said, Aaron hates me, but I have no problem with Aaron. I'm like,
oh,
okay.
That's good. All right, I'll tell him that.
Yeah.
I think he's right.
Let him know.
Yeah.
Before we wrap it up, because we're coming to an hour here. I don't want to take your whole night. What? If you could say one thing about this USFL book, again, for the people who know nothing, they're going in, no one wants a USFL book. Is there one story? Is there one moment? Is there one thing that stands out in this book that you go, here's a great example of why you should go to the store or go on Amazon and get this book right now?
All right. So I have a friend, a writer named Michael J. Lewis. It's not Michael Lewis Moneyball. It's another writer. And he keeps telling me, he's like, you got to
tell. It's like Michael B. Jordan.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not right. Yeah. He would love the comparison to Michael B. Jordan. Though, and he said, you got to tell this story. You don't tell this story enough. So I'm going to do this in honor of Michael J. Lewis. There was on the San Antonio. So the San Antonio Gunslingers were the hot ticket in San Antonio. And it's back then it was still a one horse kind of town. And those guys were getting laid left and right and doing drugs and blah, blah, blah. And they had a player named Jim Bob Morris. He was a defensive back. And Jim Bob Morris told me when he was in the USFL, he had a girlfriend in Kansas who he really cared about, but he was getting laid in San Antonio nonstop. So he had a carpenter come in to his apartment or house and install an electrician and install an answering machine in the wall. So when his girlfriend would come, he could still get the messages from all the ladies he was having sex with in San Antonio and get them left on his answering machine in the wall. And the girl from Kansas wouldn't hear it. And when she would leave, he would open up the wall and listen to all the messages left to him from all the women of San Antonio who were giving him sexual favor. However, my favorite is actually that the Chicago Blitz and the Arizona Wranglers were traded for each other. That there were two real teams, and the Chicago Blitz were owned by an Arizona guy named Ted Dietrich. And he lived in Arizona, and he hated flying 3 hours to see his team played. So he came up with the solution. It's like the only solution the USFL come up with, which is we'll just trade the teams for each other. So they took the 100 guys on the Blitz, the 100 guys on the Wranglers or whatever, 60 guys, and swapped them for each other. So the Blitz became the Wranglers. The Wranglers become the Blitz. The Blitz then hired Marv Levy as their new head coach. And Marv Levy is hired, but nobody tells him that he's not getting the Blitz, who are really good. He's getting the Wranglers, who are total shit. So he shows up, and he has this awful football team because someone forgot to tell him that he was getting his team. And the best part is, the new owner of the Blitz, after the second exhibition game, he was a guy named James Hoffman. He's walking off the field after the game with one of the players, Dan Jiggetts. And Dan Jiggetts is like, how's it going? And the owner's like, yeah, I'm out of here. And he's like, oh, where are you going? He goes, no, I'm out of here. I'm done with this team. What do you mean? He goes, yeah, I'm done. I just don't want to do this. And he just dumped the team that he just bought. Like, he didn't sell it. He didn't auction it off. He just left it on the side of the road. And the league had to take over. And as soon as the league took over the team, they fired anyone who was making any money. And the GM of the Chicago Blitz locked himself in his office on the day he was fired, picked up the phone, and called every media guy in Chicago going, you're not going to believe the crap going on around here. And, like, it was just this crazy thing, all because the owner of the Chicago Blitz got tired of flying 3 hours to his games.
It seems like this is every story. Like, I'm 150 pages in this book. It seems like this is every story. Was there any team that was run like a normal football franchise with a bunch of, like, clean-cut guys?
The Philadelphia Stars, who were they were in the championship game 3 times and won two of them.
How ironic is that, too, that Philadelphia, of all places, is like, oh, yeah, we're just...
They were great. And they, their GM was Carl Peterson, who had come from the Eagles and later with the Chiefs. And they were very into character. Like the Washington Federals, their quarterback lived in a halfway house and was a coke addict. The Stars would have never had that. So they were a team that was run very professionally and you know, like an NFL squad.
And they ended up winning?
They won 2 of the 3 USFL titles. And were the team.
These are like spoilers for the book.
Yeah, I know. it's kind of funny. I'm sure you've noticed, like, football plays a very little role in the book, actually.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to hear about the games, I don't think. But to me, the Stars, the greatest USFL story as far as what tells you the story of how important this league was, is there was a guy named, there was a coach for the Cleveland Browns named Sam Ratigliano. And he calls Carl Peterson, the GM of the Stars, and he says, listen, I have this guy we cut, and you should sign him. And he's like, well, what's he like? And he's like, well, he's a 5'9 middle linebacker. And Peterson with the Stars is like, I'm not signing any freaking 5'9 middle. He's like, just trust me. Just see him. Just bring him to camp. All right. They sign him for $40,000, and Sam Mills comes to camp and becomes one of the great linebackers in the history of professional football. At the time he signed, he was teaching photography and woodworking at East Orange High School in New Jersey. And he went on to be, I think, a Hall of Famer in the NFL. He's not in. And that's all because of USFL.
And in reading the book, that's the one thing that jumps out to me again is I wasn't old enough to remember, but they tell you all the huge names. Like whenever you would watch a Niners game, they'd show you Steve Young. Yeah. Whenever you'd see Doug Flutie or Jim Kelly, they do it. But the guys whose names as a young football fan that I remember from the league that are mentioned in this book, you're like, how so many of these guys went one way or the other. Like they went from the NFL to the USFL or vice versa.
I'll leave you with this one. I was watching, it's been about a month now, and when I was really geeking out about this book, I was watching highlights of Doug Williams' career, Doug Williams, a quarterback. And he played in the Super Bowl in 1987. That was when he became the first African-American to start in the Super Bowl. He was with the Redskins. They played the Broncos. Were you too young for this game?
No, I remember that game. Yeah.
Okay. I was watching the highlights. Doug Williams won the MVP. He threw 4 touchdown passes. He threw 1 to Calvin Bryant. He threw 1 to Ricky Sanders. He threw 1 to Gary Clark. Doug Williams was a quarterback for the Arizona Outlaws. Calvin Bryant was a star of the Philadelphia Stars. Gary Clark, Jacksonville Bulls. Ricky Sanders, Houston Gamblers. So when people say, like, what was the impact of the USFL and the NFL? I mean, there you go. You know?
Yeah.
Huge.
And even just the way I've heard you talk about the offense, it seems like the style of play was catering toward the athletes they got, and then that transferred into the NFL.
Well, it was also a time period where the NFL was still a bunch of assholes to African-American quarterbacks, and like you'd be coming out of college and they would project you as a defensive back or a running back. That you were never smart enough to play quarterback. And
I mean, a little bit still happens now, you know?
Not like the same, though. There are a large number of – there were none. I mean, it was very – Doug Williams was an anomaly back then. So – Walter Lewis comes out of Alabama. He's the exact kind of player they would have made a running back. And he goes to Memphis as a starting quarterback. Reggie Collier comes out of Southern Miss. Same kind of thing. Goes to USFL as a starting quarterback. It was 20 years before the NFL really started doing that. You know, USFL did a lot of stuff like that. Run and shoot offense, coaches challenge, 2-point conversion, USFL, Jacksonville, Tennessee. You know, They were ahead of the curve in a lot of areas.
If you guys want to know where it all started, get football for a buck. It's available now.
Not for a buck.
Not for a buck, yeah. Right. And why, before we go, why is it called football for a buck?
Oh, because do you know the answer to this? And you're
I do,
it?
But I'm giving it for them.
Yeah,
I just
that.
Assumed, actually, before I heard you say it, that I just assumed eventually it got to the point where they're a dollar to get into the games.
No, no. So ultimately they sued the NFL. And what the jury decided, they sued the NFL for monopolizing fall football, basically, fall TV. And what the jury decided is they were right, but that the USFL was its own worst enemy and Donald Trump was his own worst enemy. And what they rewarded the USFL was $1. And the best scene, my favorite scene, which you have not gotten to in the book, Donald Trump is in the courtroom when that verdict is read, and he's sitting next to John Mara from the New York Giants. And John Mara opens his suit jacket, takes out his wallet, takes out a dollar bill, and hands it to Donald Trump. It's the biggest fuck you in the history of pro football.
Donald Trump.
Handsome man. That's where we're going.
Donald Trump, the run and shoot, guys slamming their dicks in trunks, quarterbacks living in halfway houses. It's all in football for a buck. Jeff, thank you for sitting down with me. Where can everybody find you social media-wise?
It's jeffperlman.com and also at jeffperlman on Twitter.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turned the volume up high, and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about. I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey Joe, it's time to stop the show. Pack it up and away we go. Donate cause we almost broke. Everybody, that was Joe.